Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. Up next, my unedited 2015 conversation with the late Mary Oliver. There is a shorter produced version of this wherever you get your podcasts. I'm very grateful that you're doing this. I know you don't do many interviews.
No, I don't.
And I know that you're a private person, and you know, our project, we do a long-form conversation, which is rare. That said, you know, we will edit this later, and if I start going down any path you don't want to go down, just say no, and mm-hmm. we'll back up. It doesn't have to be linear, and it gets to be real. I'm trying to remember, why did I bring this? I had some reason. Yes. I know I have something on my computer, but I can't. Anyway, I'll think of it.
Just reminded me of something that I didn't mean to.
Where's the strong man? I can't.
Oh, I know.
Oh.
Lily is quite.
We don't need men. I'm going to say I'm going to eat my words pretty soon.
Well, they now have those shallow things. So, yeah.
That was really hard.
Yeah, thank you.
Jesus. Our intern actually showed me that in Minneapolis there is.
Oh, I know. That's why.
Was that what you were going to show
me? No. It's. I remember why.
With your words. It says, "Tell me what is it you plan to do?"
Oh, that's
your one well and precious life.
Could somebody go to the bathroom and get a little paper?
Sure.
Because I don't have the things to put.
Oh, posters. Sure.
Yeah, this is gonna.
I remember why I brought my phone.
Make a.
Thing.
A little ring.
Did
you read a poetry handbook?
Yes, I did. In fact, I've been reading a lot of your prose. I got all your prose books, and that was really fun because I hadn't read your prose before.
Well, that's interesting because I'm going to Penguin is going to do a selected.
Oh, they are.
Yeah.
That was very exciting. And so, the way I came to you is Anne, the Penguin Press is going to be my publisher.
Ah.
And Anne, when I met her, said, she asked if I'd ever interviewed you. And I said, no. And I understood that you did not do interviews and respected that. And she said, well,
give it a try.
She'd see.
Well, I don't go out anymore. I don't do public readings anymore.
Yeah.
I don't travel.
Yeah.
I don't travel well, so I don't travel.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they're so good to me. I feel that I should do what they ask me to do, which involves sitting down.
Okay. Well, my hope is that this might be a nourishing conversation for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to tell you a little bit about my show, or?
Yes, please.
Okay.
I'm not much of a television.
Yeah. Well, we're radio.
Internet. Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Radio and everything is internet these days, of course.
so I've heard.
Yeah. So we have a radio show called On Being,
mm-hmm.
and the idea is that we pursue the great questions of meaning that have run across human history. What does it mean to be human? How do we want to live? And kind of draw that question out in 21st century lives, and that can be. You know, those questions have long been the domain of philosophers and theologians and poets. But, you know, my sense is that, you know, that physicists are raising that question in new ways, and neuroscientists and parents and, you know, all of us in whatever we do. So I've actually had quite a few poets on the show across mm-hmm. these years, and it's really interesting. I'm just... Elizabeth Alexander, Marie Howe, those are just a few in the last couple of years. I'll just say it's really, you know, I think there's something I want to talk to you about what poetry works in us. What I know when we put a poet on the air, whether people read poetry or think poetry is important or not, you know, they respond to it like a hunger has been met.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been actually quite... fascinating and important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I keep going back to poets. And across the years, so many people have asked us if we would have you on, or have you tried to get Mary Oliver? Could you get Mary Oliver? So it's a real thrill to be here.
Well, thank
and
you.
And people...
It's a surprise to me.
No, people really... they really take our show in. They really use it. So I think we will... I know people who've known your poetry across the years will be thrilled, and I think we'll also introduce a great number of people, perhaps, to you who...
Well, that's all.
Yeah,
that's
which,
good, too.
Yeah.
Will you let me know when it's going to be
absolutely.
Aired?
Absolutely. We'll send you...
Or, I don't know if you call
CD
it aired.
Or an MP3 or whatever you want to listen to it, and it'll be on there. We're on WLRN here, but the show's on all over the place, and we'll make sure you have it.
Okay.
Okay.
Wonderful.
All right. So, yes. How are we doing? We good? All right. So I want to start. The question I always start with, whether I'm interviewing a physicist or a poet, is I'd like to hear whether there was a spiritual background to your life, to your early life, to your childhood. However you would define that now.
Well, I would define it now very differently from when I was a child. I was sent to Sunday school, as many kids are. And then I had trouble with the resurrection, so I would not join the church. But I was still probably more interested than many of the kids who did enter the church. It's been one of the most important interests of my life and continues to be. And it doesn't have to be Christianity or the better kind of Islam. I'm very much taken with the poet Rumi, mm-hmm. who is a Muslim, a Sufi poet, and read him every day, and have no answers, but have some suggestions. I know that a life is much richer with a spiritual part to it, mm-hmm. and I also think nothing is more interesting. So I cling to it, and I read about it. I did have a very, very, very dear friend, Tom Shaw, who died in October.
I didn't know Tom Shaw died in October.
He did. I knew of him, and I had read.
You wrote about him a few times.
Yes, well, we were very close
he
friends.
He was a monk,
for
and then
20
the bishop,
years.
A bishop in
yes,
Massachusetts.
Yes, he's an Episcopalian monk.
Right.
And he became the archbishop.
Right.
In Boston, and many, many people mm-hmm. are grieving over him. He had brain cancer. It was not an easy passage. But I say he changed my life. Hmm. But that is certainly an important component of my thoughts and how I try to live.
Right. And then you talk about growing up in a sad, depressed place, a difficult place. I mean, in another, you don't belabor this. I mean, in another place, there's a place you talk about. You were one of many thousands who've had insufficient childhoods, but that you spent a lot of your time walking around the woods.
Yes.
In Ohio.
I did, and I think it saved my life. To this day I don't care for the enclosure of buildings. Mm-hmm. It was a very bad childhood for everybody, every member of the household, not just myself, I think. And I escaped it, which with years of trouble. Yeah. But I did find this, the entire world, in looking for something, and that was another great part of my life. And you could forget almost everything, but not there's some things you can't forget quite. So I don't, and some people want very much to talk about it. Some people find themselves uncomfortable with it, and I find myself one of the uncomfortable ones. Mm-hmm. So I don't really go there. I think it's apparent in some poems, but I got saved by poetry, and I got saved by the beauty of the world.
Yeah, and there's such a convergence of those things.
Yes.
And it seems all the way through.
Yes.
You in your life as a poet,
It is a convergence, and I have a little difficulty now, having lived for 50 years in a small town in the north. I'm trying very hard to love the mangroves.
Well, I know.
It takes a while.
I have to say, you and your poetry, for me, are so closely identified with Provincetown and
yes.
and that part of the world and that kind of dramatic weather,
yes.
that kind of shore.
Yes.
And so when I had this amazing opportunity to come visit you, and I said, oh, great, we're going to Cape Cod. No, we're going to Florida.
Yes, well, I just sold my condo to a very dear friend this summer. Mm-hmm. And I bought a little house down here, which needs very serious reconstruction. So I'm not in it yet. But
is it on the water?
It's close to the water. Everything mm-hmm. in Home Sound is very close to the water. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's time for the change.
Yeah. Though, for all those years, for decades of your writing, you know, you really communicated this image, this picture was there of you, this pleasure of walking and writing and, I don't know, standing with your notebook.
Yes.
And actually writing while you're walking.
Yes, that's how I did it.
And it is, and it seems like, so I mean, I guess I wonder, is this something that you figured out at some point and then became second nature? It seems like such a gift that you found that way to be a writer. To have that daily habit.
Well, I don't. As I say, I don't like buildings.
Yeah.
So I was the only record I broke in school was truancy. I went to the woods a lot with books.
Right.
Whitman in the knapsack. But I also liked motion. So I just began with these little notebooks and scribbled things as they came to me, and then worked them into poems later. And always I wanted the eye. Many of the poems are, I did this, I did this, I saw this. I wanted them, the eye, to be the possible reader mm-hmm. rather than about myself. Mm-hmm. It was about an experience that happened to be mine but could well have been anybody else's. And that was my feeling about the eye. I was criticized by one editor who felt that the eye would be felt as ego. And I thought, no, well, I'm going to risk it and see. And I think it worked. It enjoined the reader into the experience of the poem.
Yes, and
made it theirs if they wanted it.
Right. Well, and as much as you allow and offer that eye as a gift to the reader, you're not absent, right? You're very present in that eye as well.
I think that's true, although I wasn't thinking of that. But it is I became the kind of person who did the walking and the scribbling.
Yeah.
But shared it.
Yeah.
If they wanted it.
Yes, I mean, so what I do is I listen, and I think a lot about how listening, real listening, is actually an act of presence, too. You know, we kind of have this idea in this culture where we're not very good at listening, that listening is being quiet while the other person says what they have to say. But really, it's about being present to what they say.
Yes.
And you also use this word, you know, there's this place where you're talking about writing while walking, you know, listening deeply. And I love this, listening convivially.
Yes. Yeah.
And listening really to the world.
Listening to the world. Well, I did that, and I still do it. Mm-hmm. I still do it.
I was going to ask you if you thought you could have been a poet in an age when you probably would have grown up writing on computers.
Oh, now? Oh, I very much advise writers not to use the computer.
But it seems to me that more than the computer being the problem. The sitting at a desk would be a problem for
that's
you.
That's a problem. Lots of things are problems. I always, as I talk about in the poetry handbook, discipline is very important.
Yes.
The habit. I think we're creative all day long, and if we have to have an appointment to have that work out on the page, and because the creative part of us gets tired of waiting or just gets tired, and it's helped a lot of students, young poets.
Yeah,
doing that. To have that meeting with that part of oneself, because there are, of course, other parts of life. I used to say I gave my, when I had jobs, which wasn't that often, but I'd say I'd give my very best second class
to the
labor to the, because I'd get up at 5 and by 9 I'd already had my my say.
Yeah, and also when you write about that the discipline that creates space for something quite mysterious to happen. I mean, this is from you talk about that wild, silky part of ourselves. You talk about the part of the psyche that works in concert with consciousness and supplies a necessary part of the poem. A heart of the star, as opposed to the shape of the star, let us say, exists in a mysterious, unmapped zone. Not unconscious, not subconscious, but cautious.
Where? What is that from?
That's from the poetry handbook.
A while.
It's great, but you promise it learns quickly what sort of courtship it's going to be. You're saying that the writer has to be kind of in courtship with this elusive, essential but elusive, cautious part, and that if you turn up every day. It will learn to trust you.
Yes, I remember that.
A very practical way about talking about something
that's quite...
The trust
is very important.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the creative process.
That is the creative process. It's also true that I believe poetry, it is a convivial and kind of... I mean, we're it's very old. It's very sacred. It's very wishes for a community. It's a community ritual, certainly, and that's why when you write a poem, you write it for anybody and everybody.
Yeah.
And you have to be ready to do that out of your single self. It's a giving. It's always a gift. It's a gift to yourself, but it's a gift to anybody who has the hunger for it.
Right. And I wonder if it's something about, this process you describe, where you've applied the will but also the discipline to, reach, and also make room for something that's very deep in us, right? I mean, I love this language, this wild, silky part of ourselves. I don't know, maybe the soul.
Become a nasty word lately. Because
I know
it
has.
It's become a lazy word.
It's
too bad.
It's cliched.
Yeah. Overused.
So yeah, the silky part, let's just call it that.
Yeah.
But I mean, so that when you offer that, I mean, poetry does create a way to offer that in a condensed form, vivid form.
It does.
Of course, how could that not elicit something unusual in the reader.
And very often, it was Blake who said, I take dictation.
Yeah.
With that discipline and with that willingness and wish to communicate, very often things very slippery do come in that you weren't planning on receiving them.
Right.
But they do happen. It does. I have very rarely... Maybe 4 or 5 times in my life, I've written a poem that I never changed, and I don't know where it came from. But it does happen. But it happens among hundreds of poems that you've struggled over.
Yeah.
But it's
do
not.
You know which? Do you know what some of those are? Do you know what they are?
Well, the Percy one was one.
Oh, okay.
The first time Percy came back.
Yeah.
I never changed a word of that. And there are others. I can't remember, but there are a few.
So
Of course, there are also poems that I just write out and then I throw them out.
Right.
Lots of those.
Well, and also, you know, when you talk about this life of waking up in the morning and being outside in this wild landscape and with your notebook in your hand and walking, it's so enviable, right? And but then I know, I mean, when you're in the poetry handbook, and I mean, clearly there's the discipline of being there, but there's also the hard work of rewriting. And as you say, some things have to be thrown out.
Oh, many, many, many have to be thrown out, for sure.
There's an unromantic part to the process as well.
Well, that's an interesting word. You know, somebody once wrote about me and said I must have a private grant or something, that all I seem to do is walk around the woods and write poems. But I was very, very poor. Mm-hmm. And I found I ate a lot of fish and a lot of clams.
Right, and I realized that you actually weren't just walking around the woods, you were gathering food.
Yes,
in those early years, mussels and clams and mushrooms and berries.
And I had decided very early that I wanted to be a poet. And that's what I would try. And that I would not be able to have brand new cupboards and a computer and a car. And very, very often in the old days, when I did go out and reading and stuff, I would meet young poets who had their first job and so forth, and they seemed to require all these things, you know, an office, right. And I, you know, a lot of poems I wrote on the kitchen table, mm-hmm. because I wouldn't give up the time and the energy to have the kind of job where you could have those unimportant things. Nice, but don't need them.
Yeah. Although you... I mean, you gave voice to this kind of really lavish, even ornate beauty that you lived in, that was your daily...
That's how
that
I
was
saw
really
it.
Your mundane world.
Yes, that's true.
So there's... In that context, it's hard to think of you having lacked for anything.
Oh, I didn't lack for anything.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I think that's what you're saying. But
yeah. I also believed and still believe, with more alarm as the years go by, that we are destroying the earth.
And you don't write about that.
No, and it's simply that I think you catch more... more flies with honey, than you do with vinegar.
Yeah.
And there are some poets who pound on that theme, and until you really can't take anymore. And I think that my way of doing it is saying, this is what we have, let's keep it.
Yeah.
Because it's beautiful and wonderful and wondrous. Might work better, though probably it's not going to work either. I mean, we're in deep trouble with the environment.
Yeah,
I believe, and you know, nobody's going to stop this business of making money, of the amassing of things that will vanish for us as we vanish. I'll leave a few poems behind, but. Not much cash.
Yeah, but you're right. It's actually hard to hear Mary Oliver say that. And it's true, I think, that the effect of your poetry, which is just to shine this light on the beauty of it.
But it works for people who are more open to it.
Mm-hmm.
It does not work, for example, to the heads of industry whose life is simply making things more profitable at whatever cost.
So there's a question that you pose in many different ways, overtly and implicitly, you know, how shall I live? In Long Life, you wrote, you know, what does it mean that the earth is so beautiful, and what shall I do about it? What is the gift that I should bring to the world? What is the life that I should live? which really is a question of moral imagination.
Yes,
it's the ancient essential question. But I wonder how you think about how that question emerges and is addressed distinctively in poetry. And through poetry, what does poetry do with a question like that, that other forms of language don't?
Well, I think I would disagree that other forms of language don't, but poetry has a different kind of attraction.
Yeah. So what is that attraction in poetry?
I think it's the way it's written. It's the fact that it has been communal for years and years and years, and we've missed it. But the question is not asked by all people.
Right.
You know, I happen to think that what we should all wish to do more than anything else in the world is to create a moral planet. But we are divided, all of us, in our feeling about that. Mm-hmm. What is moral?
And in our definition of moral. Yes.
Exactly. So yes. It's very, very hard. And everything is an argument. There's two sides to everything. And one has to pick the side, I guess. But I do think poetry has enticements of sound that are different from literature. Literature certainly has it, too. Or some literature, the best literature. And it has, it's easier for people to remember.
Mm-hmm.
People are more apt to remember a poem and therefore feel they own it.
Right.
And can speak it to themselves as you might a prayer. Then they can remember a chapter and quote it. And that's very important because then it belongs to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have it when you need it.
I also, you know, when you said a minute ago that even the definition of what's moral, that there are always two sides, but of course, 20 real morals question, there are as many sides as there are lives. And I wonder if poetry somehow, I think, transcends that flat, you know, either or pattern.
I think it reveals it in different styles, different language. There's I can't remember her name, but a fairly young woman poet, and she just got, I think, the National Book Award and another big award. And from what I've read of it, which is only parts here and there, it's very contemporary. It's not luscious to the tongue. It is more about opinion of bad things,
right? Right.
And it's people are going to want to read that too. And it's very I think it's very forceful and it's very much of its time. We need that also. And she's not talking about the beauty of the tree that was just cut down. She's talking about the ugliness of things that are going on in the country, including racism. I think she's a young black writer, I'm not sure. And that's important too. So one needs to be open to many kinds of many voices.
Mm-hmm.
But poetry is certainly closer to singing than prose.
Right, right.
And singing is something that we all love to do or wish we could do.
Yeah.
And
it goes all the way through you.
Yes, it does indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's easier to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Although this hot, fast stuff is very different from the old songs, too.
Yeah.
They change. And, I mean, I wouldn't go back to Frank Sinatra, but there are many moods in music as there are in poetry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For sure.
You wrote somewhere, you wrote in Winter Hours, you wrote that years ago you set three rules for yourself, and the they were genuine body, that it must have genuine body,
mm-hmm.
sincere energy, and the third was it must have a spiritual purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered what that what that means when you say that.
Well, now I'm not going to be helpful. I'm going to say that it means exactly what it says.
But what is it, what is a spiritual purpose? I mean,
well, it's not a physical purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an advancement of me purpose. It's not a love purpose, a personal love purpose. And there, what's left? It's not a medicinal purpose. It's not a governmental purpose. And there's not too many things. You can't make a list, a very long list of important things without including the spiritual. It's bound to be there.
It's done all the time, though.
Yeah, yes. Yes, in different ways.
It is. And I mean, I think even many very respectable poets might not use that language.
Absolutely. And many don't consider this the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, there are poets that have whole books and I don't see a suggestion of the spirit in them. And many of them are very, very, they're sardonic with the satisfaction of displaying the sardonic quality. They're deft. They're even clever. But you get nothing to take home somehow. And so there are many different editors, many different poems. And there's enough to pick and choose from. I don't begrudge anybody doing it the way they want to do it and saying what they want to say. But there's some I'll reread and there's some I won't. And mm-hmm. I think everybody does that.
Yeah. I just wanted to read, I just want to read these. This is from Long Life also. I mean, of course, your prose is very poetic, right? So that's not surprising. But the world, and to me, this gets at this thing, spirituality, where the word itself is so sometimes squishy, problematic. The world is fun and familiar and healthful and unbelievably refreshing and lovely, and it is the theater of the spiritual. It is the multiform, utterly obedient to a mystery.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is. We all wonder, who's God? What's going to happen when we die? All that stuff. And I don't think it's never nothing. I'm very fond of Lucretius.
Say some more.
And Lucretius says, well, just everything's a little energy. You go back and you're these little bits of energy and pretty soon you're something else. Now, that's a continuance. It's not the one we think of when we're talking about the golden streets and the angels with how many wings and whatever.
Right.
The hierarchy of angels. Even angels have a hierarchy. But it's something quite wonderful. That the world is pretty much, everything's mortal. It dies, but its parts don't die. Its parts become something else. And we know that when we bury a dog in the garden. And with a rose bush on top of it, we know that there is replenishment, and that's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And what more there might be, I don't know, but I'm pretty confident of that one.
And I mean, again, do you think spending your life as a poet and working with words and responding to the world in the way you have as a poet gives you, I don't know, tools to work with? Because putting words around God or what God is or who God is or, you know, I don't know, heaven, it's always insufficient.
It's always insufficient, but the quest and the wonder is not unsatisfying. It's never totally satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
But it's intriguing and also what one does end up believing, even if it shifts, has an effect upon the life that you live, or the life that you choose to live, or try to live.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an endless, unanswerable quest. I love the old myths as well. Many of the sea, the forest, all kinds of things represent something that we can use as stories. We love stories. We've always been storytellers. And many of the Christian stories are stories. And if you take Peter, who couldn't walk on the waves because his faith was not great enough. What a great way to say that his faith was not perfect. It's a story. And that makes it no less important mm-hmm. for our understanding. So I find it endlessly fascinating. And I think also religion is very helpful in people not thinking that they themselves are sufficient,
mm-hmm.
that there is something that it has to do with all of us that is more than all of us are. And people are comforted by that. Part of going to church is that you were in a community. And we're so divided. The old, good Lord, when I grew up in a little town. How many people that grew up in a little town and now the old folks are dead and the house is sold and we're in some condo somewhere and entirely different world.
Yeah.
Not a better one, I think. But that's my taste.
Yeah.
I miss the little 3,500 people in a little town that is now 300,000.
Yeah.
And the swamp that got covered over and the creek that got put in a tunnel and so forth. It's loss.
And I think, that is what you do because of the particular vision that you have, what you pay attention to, what you attend to, which is... it is that grandeur, that largeness of the natural world, which, I mean, like, this is, I should have said this before, so I wasn't quite sure how I want to work this. I think I'd like to ask you to read some poems at the end, maybe,
mm-hmm.
and have a conversation now, but if you feel like reading something, or I might ask you to read something, and I'm obviously... I've taken pieces of your prose because I was going to be having a conversation with you as a person, and that's that's a little bit closer, more reliable.
I am a person.
I know.
<It's>
and when you write your prose, you're writing as yourself, right?
Yes.
Whereas
yes.
The poetry is complicated.
Oh, I don't know.
It's you. It's
there's
you,
not
it's,
there's not much of a divide.
No.
There.
No. But I think as you said, you're more conscious of the eye of the reader as well, in it. Maybe not. Maybe you're just as
conscious.
Oh, no,
I'm just as conscious of it with prose.
Yeah. But anyway, I thought we'd focus at the end, and just I have you read from the two latest books,
mm-hmm.
because those are also where you are now in life, but also a bit from Dream Work in a minute.
Uh-huh.
And also, I have to have you read something about Percy. But anyway, I told you I came here a few days early to do some writing, and unfortunately, I love having written, and I find writing to be very painful. I know this doesn't make me special, but
I don't find it.
You don't find it painful, do you?
Little. Well, things are a little bit different now. Age can do all kind of terrible things, including making your handwriting a little different.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
it would be hard. I actually, since I have been reading you talking about always having a notebook, that was an important thing you wrote somewhere. You said you always have to have the notebook nearby.
Yeah,
it's not just a quaint tool, not just a preference, but that
in case.
You have to write it down when it comes. You don't get a second chance, and I know that's
yep.
true. But for some reason, it reminded me of that. So I've been carrying this notebook with me. But just for example, a couple of years ago when I was writing and I picked up your book, A Thousand Mornings, here's the first one. I go down to the shore I go down to the shore in the morning, and depending on the hour, the waves are rolling in or moving out. And I say, oh, I am miserable. What should I do? And the sea says in its lovely voice, excuse me, I have work to do.
I love that.
I love that. And I have to say also, to me, it was just, it's so perfect. It kind of is like, what's the point of writing 50,000, bringing 50,000 new words into the world? This says it all.
Well, I have had a rash, which seems to be continuing, of writing shorter poems. Mm-mm.
I noticed that in your more recent
and
poems.
And it probably is an influence from Rumi, whose poems are many of them are quite short. But if you can say it in a few lines, you're just decorating for the rest of it, unless you could intent make something more intense. But if you said what you want to say, you're not going to make it more intense. You're just going to repeat yourself.
Yeah.
So I've got a poem that will start the next book, and I think it goes like this. Things take the time they take. Don't worry. How many roads did St. Augustine follow before he became St. Augustine? Same kind of thing. What else is there to say? And, you know, that's four lines, and that's not a day's work, but the poem is done.
And it speaks so completely, perfectly to the eye who's reading the poem, even though it's about St. Augustine, but it's about all of us, right?
Yeah, and people do worry that they're not wherever they want to go. But and St. Augustine, I had just read a biography of him, and he was all over the map before he settled down.
Yeah, before he got holy.
Yes. Yeah.
He's a good template of a saint in how real and three-dimensional and messy they are.
Yeah, they're people.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about attention, which is another real theme that runs through your work, both the word and the practice. And I know people associate you with that word. And there are some beautiful lines. I mean, there's one I quoted in an interview. You know who Parker Palmer is, the Quaker author?
Say again.
Parker Palmer. He's a Quaker writer. Anyway, he quotes you a lot, as many people do, I'm sure you know. And it was something about attention, and I forgot to look it up before I came. But I was interested to read in some of your prose. I think this may have been from Our World, when you talked about that you began to learn that attention without feeling is only a report, that there's more to attention than for it to matter in the way you want it to matter. Say something about that learning.
You need empathy with it rather than just reporting. Reporting is for field guides, and they're great. They're helpful, but that's what they are. But they're not thought provokers, and they don't go anywhere. And I say somewhere that attention is the beginning of devotion, which I do believe. But that's it. A lot of these things are said but can't be explained.
We did a show years and years ago in the early days of my project, like 10 years ago, on prayer. And there was a quote that someone used from Simone Weil, which could have been you. Absolutely unmixed attention is prayer.
Oh, yes.
I feel like that's another way you've said it.
Yeah.
And actually, this is the reason I brought my computer. This interview is kind of self-indulgent.
No,
hope you don't mind.
No.
I brought this because...
Wait, I want to...
Yeah, say some more.
Absolute attention is not prayer if somebody is paying attention to how they can make more money in their business.
Right. to your point that there's more to this than just...
It can be prayer.
Yeah.
It can.
But that's an important distinction. And it sounds like you started to make that distinction a little later for yourself. Or you started to understand that there was empathy in the attention you were...
I think possibly when I used it, I was surrounded by what I was talking about, which was not making money. Which there's nothing wrong with making a decent amount of money.
Yeah.
But people become infatuated with it, and scam and cheat and all kind of stuff just to get more, and that's not devotion and that's not a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
In a life without that, certainly attention, perfect attention is prayer or a part of prayer or one kind of prayer. But it certainly, to me, is devotion.
I think your poem, A Summer Day, is one of the best known. And
yes, it is. I would say that's true.
Yeah. We actually, the reason I brought my computer is because that, for that old show, so my daughter, who is now 21 and all grown up, but who then was about 12, was assigned to memorize A Summer Day.
The summer day
in sixth grade. And so she came home reciting this poem, and I felt really embodying it. And we actually played it in the show.
Ah.
Because it seemed to go so well with that entire discussion of prayer. Anyway, I brought it because I wanted you to hear it.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of amazing for me to hear it again. And so remember, she's not reading it. She'd learned it.
Uh-huh.
And I just had her just come in and read it. And also I'll say, Chris is here. We're a little bit less fussy about our production. We probably would not have put music under it now, but it has music under it.
The summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Well, it's a beautiful reading.
Is that fun for you to hear?
Yeah. How old was she then?
She was about 12.
Yeah. Beautiful.
But so many young people, I mean, young and old, have learned that poem by heart, and it's become part of them.
Yeah. One thing about that poem, which I think is important, is that the grasshopper actually existed, and yet I was able to fit him into that poem. And the sugar he was eating was part of frosting from a Portuguese lady's birthday cake, you know, which wasn't important to the poem.
Right.
But even seeing that little creature come to my plate and say, I'd like a little helping of that.
Right.
It somehow fascinates me that that's just personal for me, that it was Mrs. Segura, her probably her 90th birthday cake or something.
Did she ever read the poem? Did she ever know?
No, she was past that.
Uh-huh.
Her daughters may have, but mm-hmm. I never advertised myself as a poet. And there was that wonderful thing about the town, and that is, I was taken as somebody who worked like anybody else, And I'd go, there was the one fellow who was the plumber, and we'd maybe meet in the hardware store in the morning.
You mean in Provincetown?
Yeah. And he'd say, oh, hi, Mary, how's your work going? I said, pretty good, how's yours? Yeah. And it was the same thing.
Yeah.
There was no sense of eliteness or difference. And that was very nice. I was just... In fact, it is a funny story. When I the Pulitzer Prize was announced, which I didn't even know they'd turned the book in for it. I was at that time, as the whole town was doing, going out to the dump most mornings, which was a mess. That was before they clean up to buy shingles. I was shingling the house or some kind of thing.
Right.
And a friend of mine came by, a woman who's a painter, and she said, "Ha, what are you doing? Looking for your old manuscripts?" It was very funny.
And you didn't know she'd heard the news?
I knew, but oh. My job in the morning was to go find some shingles. So.
Right. You'd been writing for 20-something years, publishing for 20-something years when you got the
more
Pulitzer
than that.
Prize, right?
When I got the Pulitzer?
Yeah. Was it 80?
Yeah, probably, because it was my fourth book. And I think I published the first one in... just before I was 30.
63, maybe? Did I read that?
It sounds good. I don't remember. I really don't. It was a fourth book, maybe 76.
The Pulitzer?
Maybe.
I think it was in the 80s, wasn't it?
I think that was the National Book Award.
Oh, okay. Oh, well. So many awards. So many awards to remember so little time. I wanted to I wanted to also name the fact that although you don't, as you said before, you're not somebody who belabors what is dark, what has been hard. I think it's important and maybe helpful for people because there's so much beauty and light in your poetry also that you let in the fact that it's not all sweetness and light. And you did that a lot in the Dream Work book.
I did.
And those poems are notably
And a lot
harder.
Of them I didn't know at that time what I was writing about. I really had no understanding.
You mean you didn't realize that they were so hard, or you literally didn't know what you were...
No, there's a poem called Rage.
Yes.
And it says she.
Yeah.
And that's perfect biography. Unfortunately, or autobiography, but I couldn't handle that material except in the three or four poems that I've done. Just couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's a line in Rage: "In your dreams, you have sullied and murdered, and your dreams do not lie."
Yeah,
and that's
That's how I felt, but I didn't know I was talking about my father. I mean, the whole business of children forget. I mean, they don't forget, but they forget the details. They just don't know why they have nightmares all the time. You know, it's very difficult.
Isn't it incredible that we carry those things all our lives?
Well,
decades and decades.
We do carry them, but it is very helpful to figure out, as best you can, what happened and why these people were the way they were.
Yeah.
And it was a very dark and broken house that I came from.
I mean, there's that poem in there, A Visitor, mm-hmm. which mentions your father, and there's just, you know, to me, this heartbreaking line, which also I have my own story, we all do. I saw what love might have done
had we loved in time. Yeah. Well, he never got any love out of me.
Yeah.
Or deserved it. But what mostly makes you angry is the loss of the years of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does leave damage.
Mm-hmm.
But there you are. You do what you can do.
And I think the... there's so much... You have such a capacity for joy, especially in the outdoors, right?
Yeah.
And you transmit that, and it's that joy. You know, if you're capable of that, having, you know, how much more of it would there have been?
Well, I saved my own life by finding a place that wasn't in that house. Mm-hmm. And that was my strength. But I wasn't all strength. And it would have been a very different life, whether I would have written poetry or not. Who knows?
Yeah.
Poetry is a pretty lonely pursuit. And in many cases, I used to think, I don't do it anymore, but I'm talking to myself. There was nobody else in that house I was going to talk to.
Yeah.
And it was a very difficult time. And a long time. And I don't understand some people's behavior.
But I guess what I'm saying, I think, is that it's a gift that you give to your readers to let that be clear, that this, you know, that your ability to love your one wild and precious life is hard won.
Yeah.
That, you know, you said that off in the world of those woods and that shore, that was your salvation from
yeah.
your own darkness.
Yes, I set out to save my life. I really did. And I feel very strongly that the people like Sylvia Plath mm-hmm. somehow didn't get on that road. And Anne Sexton as well. And it's a darn shame.
It's such a long list, yeah.
They were good poets, but they wrote to tell how they felt. They didn't write to offer a good experience to another person. Mm. And that I always intended to do. What was trouble was my own business. And not worth advertising. Granted, there are some poems, but it becomes a minor theme, I think, against the rest.
Yes. There's a place where you... I think that's really important, what you just said, that there's some intentionality that shifts the effect of the poem, both in you mm-hmm. and in the person reading it.
Oh, I very much feel like I'm writing to you mm-hmm. and you and you and you, two and four. And I think that I have a poem that begins, "Have you noticed?" I can't think what poem it is, but that's a question addressed. I've noticed. Have you noticed?
Right.
And meaning notice.
There are these lines from a poem in Blue Horses, "Good Morning." "As for the poem, not this poem, but any poem, do you feel its sting? Do you feel its hope, its entrance to a community? Do you feel its hand in your hand?" Which is also what you're saying. I mean, that is your intention. But also that the sting, and isn't the sting, in the moths, you know, it's like it's the hard side of paying attention. That if you pay attention, you see more.
Yeah.
And some of what you will be painful, and some of what you see may feel unbearable.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, just in those few lines, it's describing what you have aspired to do, and I think succeeded at doing, which is not hiding the sting, but kind of transforming it, kind of shifting it.
Yeah, and notice the other things with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That you don't let the sting have the last
No,
beat.
The sting does not have the last word.
No. Hmm. And I mean, you know, here's another, I feel like you also, for all the glorious language about God and around God that goes all the way through your poetry, you know, you also acknowledge this perplexing thing. I mean, this was in Long Life. What can we do about God who makes and then breaks every God-forsaken beautiful day?
Well, we can go back and read Lucretius.
What does Lucretius do then?
Well, Lucretius just presents this marvelous and important idea that what we are made of will make something else. Which to me is very important. That there is no nothingness.
Yeah.
With these little atoms that run around, too little for us to see, but put together they make something. And that to me is a miracle. Now, where it came from, I don't know, but it's a miracle. And I think it's enough to keep a person afloat.
Well, let's talk about your last couple of books, which also are an insight into you at this stage in your life. And then I'd love for you to read some poems.
Okay.
You have said that that you were so captivated, that you were, I mean, I don't know if you've said it this way, but it seems to me you've kind of written about being so captivated by the world of nature that you were less open to the world of humans.
Yes.
And that as you've grown older, as you've gone through life, what did you say? You've entered more fully into the human world
yes.
and embraced it. Is that a good,
It's true. It's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. And was it passage of time? I mean,
It was passage of time as a passage of understanding what happened to me and why I behaved in certain ways and didn't in other ways. So it was clarity.
Yeah, self-knowledge.
That helped me. And many good friends. I have many, many just wonderful friends. Unfortunately, a number of them are in their 80s, which is scary. But a lot of them are not. They're quite a bit younger.
Mm-hmm.
And they come down here. I can't get there, so they come here, which is, great. And that, that helped.
Yeah.
That's a healing.
Yeah.
And they have their hang-ups and trouble, too. So we can, though I must say lately, sometimes we sit around and talk about, how are you feeling this week? like you hear old codgers do that. Well, we've entered that realm.
There's a poem that I think I've heard a lot that's quite famous also. Is it The Visitor? There's a line about I don't want to die having only visited. I'm ruining your own line. That's really.
Yes, that's at the end of. It's not. It's only in the Noon Selected Volume 1, and it's When Death Comes.
When Death Comes, yes. And then I mean. You wrote really beautifully about the death of Molly,
yes.
who you shared so much of your life with. And you wrote, I don't know, I'm finding my notes. The end of life has its own nature also worth our attention.
Yeah.
I liked that line.
Yeah.
And in some ways it feels to me when I read your poetry of the last couple of years that's really this territory you're on. Or at least
well,
part of it.
I should be.
I don't mean that the end of life, but just paying attention.
I've been better.
But just it's a different chapter.
It is. I mean, I had cancer a couple of years ago.
Right.
Lung cancer. And it feels that death has left his calling card. I'm fine. I get scanned, as they do. I'm lucky. I'm very lucky. But all the same, you're kind of shocked, and you have to get checked up on, and it's different. This doctor, that doctor, a bad smoker.
And you're still smoking.
Yep, and last time the doctor said, your lungs are good. Well, if you get good fortune, take it. And you keep smoking.
There's that poem, The Fourth Sign of the Zodiac, in the new book.
How does that start? Which one is that? That's one of the poems about cancer.
Well, right. And, you know, you haven't, I don't think, have you spoken much about your cancer? No. People know that you were ill.
People knew I was ill or they didn't know.
They didn't know what it was. No. In that poem, there's, where is it? There's a very passing reference to it.
Oh, yes, there is. There are four poems. One is about the hunter in the woods that makes no sound, all the hunters.
There it is, 61.
But I can't remember which one of the four that is. I mean, the fourth...
It's a little bit long, but do you want to read it?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, where did I put my glasses? Out there. Yeah, the fourth sign of the zodiac is, of course, Cancer. Oh, that's what I meant. Why should I have been surprised? Hunters walk the forest without a sound. The hunter strapped to his rifle, the fox on his feet of silk, the serpent on his empire of muscles, all move in a stillness, hungry, careful, intent, just as the cancer entered the forest of my body without a sound. Now, these four poems are about the cancer episode, shall we say? The cancer visit. Did you want me to go on to these others?
Yeah, you want to go.
Oh.
Mm. Is it too much?
No.
Okay.
This is the second poem of these four. The question is, what will it be like after the last day? Will I float into the sky, or will I fray within the earth or a river, remembering nothing? How desperate I would be if I couldn't remember the sun rising, if I couldn't remember trees, rivers, if I couldn't even remember, beloved, your beloved name. 3. I know you never intended to be in this world, but you're in it all the same. So why not get started immediately? I mean, belonging to it. There is so much to admire, to weep over, and to write music or poems about. Bless the feet that take you to and fro. Bless the eyes and the listening ears. Bless the tongue, the marvel of taste. Bless touching. You could live 100 years, it's happened, or not. I am speaking from the fortunate platform of many years, none of which I think I ever wasted. Do you need a prod? Do you need a little darkness to get you going? Let me be as urgent as a knife then, and remind you of Keats, so single of purpose and thinking for a while, he had a lifetime. 4. Late yesterday afternoon in the heat, all the fragile blue flowers in bloom in the shrubs in the yard next door had tumbled from the shrubs and lay wrinkled and faded on the grass. But this morning the shrubs were full of the blue flowers again. There wasn't a single one on the grass. How, I wondered, do they roll or crawl back to the shrubs and then back up to the branches, that fiercely wanting, as we all do, just a little more of life?
Hmm. There are some of your poems, and Wild the Summer Day is one, and Wild Geese is another, that have just entered the lexicon.
Yeah, three: the Summer Day, Wild Geese,
The Journey, maybe.
No. Summer Day, Wild Geese. There's one other. I can't remember, but I would say is the third one. But I don't remember it.
If you think of it, tell me. So Wild Geese is in Dream Work, which we talked about, is that there's a lot of darkness in that book. I mean, is that a poem? And I've heard people talk about that, Wild Geese, as a poem that has saved lives. And I wonder if when you write something like that, I mean, when you wrote that poem, do you know that? Or when you published this book, would you have known that that was the poem that would speak so deeply to people?
This is the magic of it. That poem was written as an exercise in end-stopped lines.
As an exercise in what?
End-stopped lines, period, at the end of the line. I was working with a poet. I had her in a class.
So it was an exercise in technique.
Yes. Yes. And it's, not every line is that way. I was trying to show the variation. But my mind was completely on that. At the same time, I will say that I heard the Wild Geese. I mean, I just started out to do this for this friend and show her the effect of the line end is, you've said something definite. It's very different from enjambment. And I love all that difference. And that's what I was doing.
To your point that the mysteries and that combination of the discipline and the convivial listening.
Yeah, I was trying to do a certain kind of construction. Nevertheless, once I started writing the poem, it was the poem, and I knew the construction well enough that I didn't have to think about, just do I have a, need an end sound line here, or is this where I should... It just worked itself out the way I wanted for the exercise.
Would you read that one?
Sure. That's a kind of a secret, but... But it's the truth. Wild Geese. I actually thought it was... Oh, no, there it is, 14, you're right. No. Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Well, it's a subject I knew well a lot about.
Yeah.
You know, so it...
It was
so,
just there in you.
It what?
It was there in you.
It was
you
there in me, yes. Once I heard those geese and, you know, said a line about anguish and where that comfort came from, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'd say that's one of the poems that...
That just came.
Yeah. It wasn't dictated, but that's what Blake used to say.
Yeah.
Once in a while he took dictation. And that's just a way of saying you don't know where it comes from.
Yeah.
But if you've done it a lot, and Lord knows when I started writing poetry, it was rotten.
The poetry was rotten?
Sure. I mean, I was 10, 11, 12 years old. But I kept at it. I used to say, with my pencil, I've traveled to the moon and back probably a few times. I kept at it every day. And finally, you learn things.
Are you still here in this very different landscape? Are you still standing with your notebook every morning? Outside?
Not as much. And I've had some periods of time of rather bad health. And in the north, with which I was very familiar, I'd go out in the woods and I'd always see something. And it's very different down here. It's very seasonal. I thought all the birds were down here in the winter. Unfortunately, they're farther south, and you see them passing by. And the birds are very, a lot of them are large and exotic.
Right.
It's like a different world.
You've written, you know, another thing you've said is that as you've gotten older, you've become something you never were before, which is funny.
You've become more funny. Yeah, I can be.
And the Blue Horses book, which is the 2014 book, has a lot of whimsy to it, including about this place, this new landscape, right? Yeah. When you said that you made the remark about the mangroves, you have this really wonderful language about how the trees are so leggy.
Yes. Yeah, Something affinity takes longer. Affection's easy, but affinity takes a while. Well, it's true. When I walk from here just down to the intercoastal, mangroves. Once in a while, an otter, which is very nice to see, mm-hmm. and a heron, and maybe the porpoises in the water. Or a couple of times I've seen the manatees, but it's not the same, and it's a really shocking difference. And I've chosen it, but there is a kind of emotional element in the fact that things have disappeared. My town, my house, and the town was very different by the time I left.
Provincetown had already changed.
Provincetown was changing very mm-hmm. rapidly into a kind of little Hampton. Mm-hmm. You know, the wealthier, successful people were coming in. It wasn't the hardworking artists and writers anymore. So that was different. But nevertheless, the woods were there, and I do miss them. And I was there 50 years. That's a long time.
Yeah. And the weather was there.
Well, I fell down a couple of times in the winter, broke bones. So it was time not to do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm conscious that I want to move towards a close. I'd like to hear a little bit more. I mean, you mentioned Rumi a few times. In A Thousand Mornings, you say, if I were a Sufi for sure, I would be one of the spinning dancing kind. Yeah. And that's clear. I mean, that actually it makes so much sense from mm-hmm. how you were always on the move, even as a teenager. How do you think your spiritual sensibility, and here we are again with that tricky word, but how has your spiritual... I don't want to say how's your spiritual life, you know. I mean, you've said somewhere you've become more spiritual as you've grown older. And I mean, what do you mean when you say that? What's the content of that?
I've become kinder, more people-oriented, more willing to grow old. I always was investigative in terms of everlasting life, but a little more interested now, a little more content with my answers. Right now is a difficult time because, as I say, Tom Shaw was my, what do you call it?
He's kind of like your spiritual...
Oh, he was.
Advisor.
When we first knew him, he was a bishop. And he'd come to our house. He came to Bennington when I taught there and stayed for a few days. But as he became archbishop, he became very busy. So we lost that. I mean, we still talk to the phone and so forth. But, mm-hmm. And I used to go to the monastery sometimes and stay there. And he was a wonderful man. Good sense of humor also. Mm-hmm. This was in the obituary. He lived with his brothers. He would not take the archbishop's house.
No.
And once he went home, he had an office and everything at the cathedral. But he went home and he had a very big cross, forget what it's called, as the archbishop. And he always put it under his shirt so he would be just like the other brothers. And some woman that he... came in, or didn't know very well, but came in and said, why do you have a cross? And none of the other brothers have it. And quick as a wink, he said, oh, I'm monk of the month.
Really?
Because he didn't want any difference.
I'm a bishop.
A monk of the month. And he had that kind of wonderful yeah. humor. But a wonderful man.
There's this poem, the second poem in A Thousand Mornings, which is your 2013 book, which also to me just kind of it's like says it all. What's the point of that I happen to be standing? Would you read that one?
Oh, yeah.
Which is just, well, there it is.
Yeah. I don't know where prayers go or what they do. Do cats pray while they sleep half asleep in the sun? Does the opossum pray as it crosses the street? The sunflowers, the old black oak growing older every year? I know I can walk through the world along the shore or under the trees with my mind filled with things of little importance in full self-attendance, a condition I can't really call being alive. Is a prayer a gift or a petition, or does it matter? The sunflowers blaze, maybe that's their way. Maybe the cats are sound asleep, maybe not. While I was thinking this, I happened to be standing just outside my door with my notebook open, which is the way I begin every morning. Then a wren in the privet began to sing. He was positively drenched in enthusiasm. I don't know why. And yet, why not? I wouldn't persuade you from whatever you believe or whatever you don't. That's your business. But I thought of the wrens singing. What could this be if it isn't a prayer? So I just listened, my pen in the air. Yeah, that's... Well, the poems keep coming.
The matter of dogs.
Uh-huh. The matter of
the
dogs.
The matter of dogs.
The matter of dogs.
The matter.
The matter of dogs. They matter.
They matter. Do you have a dog now?
No, I don't. Percy died, and that was my last dog. But I may get one.
Yeah.
When I get my own little house.
This has been a really... Did your dogs become more important to you, or did you just start to write about them more?
Oh, Percy was very important to me. All of them were very important to me.
Yeah.
I forget whose idea it was. It might have been Charlotte Sheedy's idea, or Anne Goodoff.
To put the dog poems together?
Yeah. I have a feeling it was.
And you said one of those poems about Percy was the one of your poems that came out perfectly from...
Yes.
Came out perfectly formed. Do you want to read that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was what I call a smoothie. Let's see. Actually, it's not in the end of the book. I'll have to look at the contents. I don't know where it is. 77.
I was wondering this as I was reading you, because you've written so many poems over such a long period of time. Do you remember your poems, and do you revisit them?
No, I don't revisit unless I'm looking for something. I know if I went through everything, I'd find too much that was repetitious, so I'd leave it alone. But yes, I know. No, I don't revisit them.
Yeah.
Unless there's a reason. The first time Percy came back. The first time Percy came back, he was not sailing on a cloud. He was loping along the sand as though he had come a great way. "Percy," I cried out and reached to him, those white curls. But he was unreachable, as music is present, yet you can't touch it. "Yes, it's all different," he said. "You're going to be very surprised." But I wasn't thinking of that. I only wanted to hold him. "Listen," he said, "I miss that too. But now you'll be telling stories of my coming back, and they won't be false and they won't be true, but they'll be real." And then, as he used to, he said, "Let's go." And we walked down the beach together.
There's something in there about that such lovely distinction between true and real, and how a poem tells the truth, which is different.
Yeah, from, yeah. Oh, that I like that poem, and I love that dog. I love that dog. He was a rescue dog, mm-hmm. and he had, which I suggest in that long, the long last poem. He had only one functioning kidney, so I took him to a sonogram fellow who told me that, and he said he won't live past 3. But you just can't do it. The other kidney looks pretty bad too, and I took him back again when he was 6, and the sonogram fellow said, you don't do this. You're putting me on. That can't be Percy. It is impossible for that dog to...
You'd gotten another dog and brought another dog to him.
It's impossible for that to be Percy. Right. I said, it's Percy. And he looked at the sonogram. He said, yes, indeed, it is Percy. I don't know how this could be. And I told him something that was really quite valuable, I think. He couldn't process his kidney. Poor one kidney could not process things. Any kind of unnatural thing.
Yeah.
So I had a friend of mine for however many years that was, 6 years or something, brought me 4 gallons of water from his well every week. And I never gave him the town water, which had chlorine in it. Mm. And I think that made a big difference. Mm. I mean, of course, he ate roast chicken and leg of lamb and various nice things.
Yeah.
But he lasted until he got weak. That's how we knew. He just got terrible, terrible weak.
Have your dogs and your love of your dogs and life with dogs infused your theology? Or is that too lofty a question?
Well, you know, Pope Francis has talked about paradise is open to all of God's creatures. And somebody said, what about the mosquitoes? But Rilke wrote a poem, a friend of mine did a painting of it, of just a picture of a dog. And the quote is, the soul for which there is no heaven. Hmm. Well, no thank you. I mean, there are going to be trees in paradise, as we're going to have fun imagining it, whether it exists or not. Dogs are certainly going to be there. Poor little burros and donkeys after all the work they've done in the world. Good heavens, yes.
Right.
You know, I'm sure of that. 5 white rhinoceros left, but we'll find all the rest of them eventually. sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the reason I brought my phone, I remembered, is that I was texting. Do you text? Are you a texter? Do you have a phone?
Yeah. Oh, text. Yeah. I don't do it.
Okay. Well, I didn't start for a while, but now I like. Anyway, so last night I'm texting. I'm here in Florida, and I'm texting with a dear friend of mine who was a friend of mine and before she became the mayor of a major American city. And right now she's at this big mayor's conference at the White House. I think it's in Washington. And it's mayors from all over the country, and they're talking with police officers, and they're talking about all these hugely important, you know, anguishing, but critical things mm-hmm. that we have to talk about. So I told her that I was here and I was going to interview Mary Oliver. And she says, Mary Oliver is one of my all-time favorite poets. She's how I figured out I didn't have to read poetry the right way or like poetry the right way. Mm. That opened the door for me to just enjoy poetry with my untrained heart. Now I read poetry every single morning when I wake up and every night before bed. I could not do my job without poetry, not the way it needs doing.
Wow.
And I just I'd bring that for you because she's a mayor who's dealing with all these terrible, complicated issues.
Yeah.
Well,
when you speak to her, tell her you read it and I thank her.
Okay.
My work's doing it.
Yeah, what? Sorry.
My work is made it's nice to hear.
Yeah.
It's nice to get feedback.
Yeah. And I mean, I just, you know, in the poetry handbook you wrote, poetry is a life-cherishing force, and it requires a vision, a faith, to use an old-fashioned term. Yes, indeed. For poems are not words, after all, but fires for the cold, ropes let down to the lost, something as necessary as bread in the pockets of the hungry. Yes, indeed. And I just wanted to read that back to you, because I feel like you've given that to so many people. You've demonstrated that. And, you know, you also write in poetry about thinking of Schubert scribbling on a cafe napkin. Thank you. And I feel like so many people, when they read, when they imagine you standing outdoors with your notebook and pen in hand, you know, thank you. I wonder if there are any poems of any of these books, the new ones or Dream Work, there's anything that, it would be interesting to me if there's any poem in those that you would want to read.
I'll read The Blue Horses.
Okay.
Franz Marc's Blue Horses. Because they are beautiful, those horses.
It's the painting.
Yeah.
Which is on the cover of the book.
Yep.
I love the way you, and I recognize this also in myself, and maybe this also comes with, for those of us who had hard childhoods, that experiencing writers, and also, you know, Franz Marc, I feel for you, is also just these artists as friends across time and space,
mm-hmm.
real companions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big, Beethoven. Important thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a line in a new poem. You could read the entire works of, or you could hear the entire works of Beethoven, you will never find a single lie.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the entire works, I can't remember exactly. But in the entire works of Beethoven, you will not find a single lie. Franz Marc's Blue Horses. I step into the painting of the four blue horses. I am not even surprised that I can do this. One of the horses walks toward me. His blue nose noses me lightly. I put my arm over his blue mane, not holding on, just commingling. He allows me my pleasure. Franz Marc died a young man, shrapnel in his brain. I would rather die than try to explain to the blue horses what war is. They would either faint in horror or simply find it impossible to believe. I do not know how to thank you, Franz Marc. Maybe our world will grow kinder eventually. Maybe the desire to make something beautiful is the peace of God that is inside each of us. Now all four horses have come closer, are bending their faces toward me as if they have secrets to tell. I don't expect them to speak, and they don't. If being so beautiful isn't enough, what could they possibly say?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's been a beautiful conversation.
You're much welcome. I'm free.
Yes, you are.
before I move the mics, can I just have just 10 seconds of quiet so that we can...
The sound of the room.